This is Talk Is Cheap on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, today, Lauren Reagan from the Civil Liberties Defense Center on state repression and what you can do about it. This was recorded by the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network. And for more information on the Civil Liberties Defense Center and to support them, go to cldc.org. That's cldc.org. Very important organization here in Eugene. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Thanks. Thank you very much, David. And thanks, everybody, for having me today. Very excited to be here. As David mentioned, my hope today is to focus on state repression as it relates to political activists. Basically, kind of a short version of one of many Know Your Rights trainings that we do for movement participants, primarily environmental and social justice activists. Our organization is anti-capitalist. Many of us identify as anarchists or far leftists, and we are abolitionists as well. So I'm going to share my screen and show you some slides as I kind of like walk through, just some basic information around what we mean when we say state repression and what we can do about it. A lot of people, when they hear that term, when they think about government surveillance, it's all kind of scary boogeyman topics that most people sort of want to cover their ears and, kind of crawl into a small cave. But the reason that we want to talk about this information is because, the government certainly knows it. And there are actually lots of things that we can do as activists to make our community safer and to protect us from some of the worst consequences of state repression. So when we're talking about sort of the legal landscape in this world, and we're talking about, why we should know what our rights are, or why we should have trainings like this, one of the first things that we hope to instill in people is the ability to think on their own feet, the ability to engage in your own risk assessment. Because when we're talking about state repression and digital security and, these kinds of topics, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. If I'm planning a bake sale, I don't need to use the level of precautions or security that I would use if I was planning a political action that I wanted to keep away from my adversaries. In the same way, we're also hoping to basically help give people skills with regard to like harm reduction or harm mitigation in the legal landscape. Meaning sometimes, we've certainly seen this week, sometimes people choose to get arrested. But there are things that we can do to ensure that the power of the state doesn't, come crashing down on them in the worst possible ways. This will ensure that we can both better protect ourselves and protect our communities and often the most vulnerable people in those communities. Finally, over decades, as political movements, we have gained strength and power against Big Brother, against government and corporations. And we don't want to have to like go back to square one. We want to be moving forward, with those strengths and with those gains. And so by ensuring that we understand our history, we will not be bound to repeat it, so to speak. Oftentimes when I talk about this topic, I will have somebody in the audience basically say, well, I'm not doing direct action. I'm not doing anything illegal. Why should I care about this topic? And I really think Edward Snowden, said it best when he said, when you say, I don't care about the right to privacy because I have nothing to hide, that is no different than saying, I don't care about freedom of speech because I have nothing to say, or freedom of press because I have nothing to write. Now we do a whole separate training on knowing your rights and how to engage with cops. And this slide is basically what we call our magic words. These are the basic ways to assert your constitutional rights when you're engaging with police or government agents. If you are stopped by the cops, whether it's in your car or on the streets, the first thing that you want to ask them is, am I being detained? Because that the answer to that question basically tells you whether or not you're free to walk away or whether or not you have to remain with the cop. And also it tells you whether or not you have to identify yourself or not. So am I being detained? Why am I being detained? And no matter what the answer to those questions are, you can always say, I don't consent to this search, exercising your Fourth Amendment right. Even if you think that the cops have a lawful right to search you, you still want to say, I don't consent to the search, because it gives lawyers something to fight about in the event that you end up in court. And then finally, invoking your Fifth Amendment right, that taking the fifth, as you might have heard, on TV, by saying the words, I'm going to remain silent and I want a lawyer, that puts a magic bubble around you that basically requires the cops to stop questioning you. Now, in talking about state suppression specifically, a couple of resources for folks that want to do a deeper dive into this. Tilted Scales Collective, we wrote some guides. One is a defendant's guide to being a defendant. There's also a guide for lawyers in representing political activists. Green is the New Red. And if you haven't seen the documentary, If a Tree Falls, that's sort of your deeper dive into an era of state repression that Tony and I lived through up here in Cascadia, which was when the largest roundup of Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front activists occurred at the hands of the federal government after 9/11 and after the passage of the Patriot Act. So to sort of set the stage, I wanted to define what is the state, because people can mean different things by this. But as David mentioned, to us, the state refers to both government and corporations. And part of the reason that we believe that to be true is because there is a revolving door of CEOs that go become cabinet members in the federal government or go, lead federal agencies and then leave and go back to their corporate CEO jobs and then come back into government. We know that those two entities are in bed together and they are really in place to facilitate each other's profit motivations and to ensure that the US remains a real strong capitalist, bulwark, basically, for profiteering. So now that we've defined the state, what I believe, I feel like we pick teams, and you're either on the teams of the state or you're on the team of movements. And it's important for people to pick a team because the state generally is the adversary for almost every environmental or social justice movement or campaign that exists. You are either fighting against corporations in some way, or you're fighting against government agencies. And the state has a lot of power and resources on its side. But what we have that the state will never have is passion, ethics. We have volunteers that do this work for free. They are not working 9 to 5 and collecting a paycheck in order to do this work. And often, the state is just bewildered and confused by, people who do things for free, people who do things on the weekends. We constantly hear corporations, especially in like pipeline contexts, basically saying like, somebody must be paying these people to get arrested. Someone must be telling them what to do. They constantly are trying to put social justice movements into a hierarchy that they understand, like a corporate structure. And for all of those reasons, the nimble, agile, creative, morally high ground, versions of movements are what, give us the people power to have lasted, as long as we have. Back in 2008, during the Republican National Convention, hundreds of activists, environmental and social justice activists from across the spectrum of our movement spaces got together and came up with a consensus-based set of principles on how different organizations, different movements, using all sorts of different strategies and tactics, could come together in a single geographic location and harmonize, our tactics and our interests. And so the St. Paul principles were created then, but they remain incredibly strong and vibrant today, even in our current moment of, of occupations and encampments around the country against the genocide in Gaza and beyond. And so the St. Paul principles are solidarity will be based on a respect for a diversity of tactics and the plans of other groups. The actions and tactics used will be organized to maintain a separation of time or space. This basically means if you're doing a noise demo, I'm not going to have my silent vigil, 3 feet away from you. For instance, Black Bloc and Raging Grannies probably shouldn't be in the exact same physical proximity of each other, both for tactic and safety reasons. Any debates or criticisms will stay internal to the movement, avoiding any public or media denunciations of fellow activists and events. Shit talking each other's tactics is just what the state wants us to do. That divide and conquer mentality is a win for them. And especially in the advent of social media, there are cops and government agencies that do nothing except sit in front of computer screens all day monitoring social media, and just looking for the Achilles heel of a particular campaign or movement that they can exploit. And we'll talk about that more. And finally, we oppose any state repression of dissent, including surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and violence. We agree not to assist law enforcement actions against activists and others. So when I use the word state repression, it actually means a lot of things. There are many different forms of state repression, like legislation, unlawful arrests and excessive bail, overcharging people or overpunishing them, surveillance, the use of grand juries as witch hunts, slap suits, and RICO actions, which we'll talk about a little bit more. All of these are tools of the bully, of state power that are intended to try to break the backs of social movements. Each one of these things, is nothing new. This has been going on since the history of movement spaces, and we have developed ways to dance around some of the worst, obstacles of these. For students or younger people that are perhaps listening to this, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to know our history. The saying, "Know your history or you're bound to repeat it," is really true. The state has a pretty limited playbook that they keep reusing and recycling. And so knowing what the state came at people with, during the 60s, the 70s, the 50s, these older eras is really instructive, because we are seeing many of the same things again, particularly in the moment we're in. Everybody's been seeing the news and talking about the 1968 Vietnam War protests at Columbia, for instance, as compared to, now and the anti-war protests, on behalf of the people of Gaza. Even in the same buildings, the same type of protests are going on. Knowing what worked and what didn't work makes us a stronger, movement in the current moment. And as I mentioned, state repression has a long history that ebbs and flows. There are moments of heightened state repression, and there have been moments where there have been lulls. But state repression against political activists over the history of the United States has included assassinations, It has included lengthy imprisonment. You know, our movements have had and have martyrs currently. You know, it's important to plan for the worst and hope for the best whenever you are engaging in environmental and social justice change. Taking just a brief look at legislation, you know, we have seen a flood of anti-protest legislation over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years. What's important to know about all of this anti-protest legislation, however, is that many activists engaged in civil disobedience or direct action knowingly plan to break the law. It really doesn't matter what the name of the law is that they are going to be charged with. You know, we cannot control what a prosecutor ultimately charges us with. We may think that we're engaging in trespassing and the state can charge you with RICO. So when activists go into engaging in direct action or civil disobedience, we try to give a range of risks, and we hope that people have knowledge and consent when they make the decision to engage in those risks. But there's always the chance that the state is going to try and escalate its bully tactics. When you see that, when you see a flood of legislation, you know, like what is happening right now, when you see things like what is happening down in Atlanta with regard to Cop City, you should think in your head, this is happening because we are winning. You know, when you see the bully kind of pull out the stops, it's because they are on the losing end of the court of public opinion. They are attempting to retake control of the narrative by trying to convince normies that protest is criminal, you know, that protest is bad, and that what they're doing in raping and pillaging the environment and society is actually righteous and good. And so it's, you know, the other reason that you will see these kinds of floods happening is truly to chill the First Amendment right to assemble, to associate, to come together and use collective power to make change. You know, these are principled constitutional rights that are at the core of any healthy democracy. We know that we don't have a particularly healthy democracy at this moment, but when people say to me, you know, I'm afraid of these new anti-protest laws that are coming out, you know, I understand that. And that is 100% the intent of the state and their lobbyists to be passing those laws. When you see bully tactics like that happening, one of the best general frames to be thinking about is, you know, if they think that what they're going to do is going to scare us into submission, the best antidote for that is to redouble our efforts and make sure that the state knows that that as a tactic is not a winner for them. If they think that they have found something that is actually winning for them, you will see them use it time and time again. If we do our best to neutralize that tactic and to even show maybe a little bit of a fake smile, you know, maybe we really are scared. That is normal. But we want to make sure that to the state and to the like larger public, that we do our best to not show fear, to not show that this is a tactic that will, you know, cause harm to our movements, that will actually provide the chill that the state is looking to create. Groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Federalist Society, and other basically, you know, lobbyist bootlickers for massive industries and corporations are constantly attempting to undermine our democracy by passing model legislation that they sell basically to state legislators, hoping to pass new state laws. They focus on the state because and by that, I mean like, you know, Oregon, California state, not the, you know, the larger state. They focus on states because they expect that state legislators have less capacity, less staff. They're going to be more reliant on having like these outside lobbyists tell them, hey, go pass this law. We wrote it for you. It's great. It's just what you wanted. You know, go go get it passed in your legislature. Also, they expect that there's like less scrutiny, less potential attention that can be focused on every state. If this is an area that you are interested in, I would really direct you to ICNL, the Center for Not-for-Profit Law. They have an anti-protest law tracking infrastructure on their website. This map that I'm showing you is actually from 2019, but it's just an example of one of the things that the ICNL tracks. You know, by issue area, by state, you can look at bills that are pending, bills that have passed, bills that have failed. I'll tell you, the overarching number of bills, more often than not, fail. You know, more often than not, they are not getting passed in most states. Of course, there are some areas like Alabama, you know, Oklahoma, that are really having some struggles right now in terms of bad laws that are being passed. The thing that is important to think about when we're looking at some of these new laws, though, is not the name of them, not what the state, you know, wants to further criminalize, but really, is it a misdemeanor or is it a felony? Because that's really kind of where the focus should be. Felony risks and felony convictions can have more serious consequences than misdemeanors. Generally speaking, you know, activism and misdemeanors, not super scary. When you get into certain felony convictions, however, that can impact licensing, it could impact gun rights, you know, and different things that might be specific to the state that you are in. Just to give you, you know, an example, though, a lot of these bills and a lot of these laws, like this new Georgia domestic terrorism law that was passed after the movement against Cop City became a global, strong political movement. You know, all of a sudden we see Georgia passing this law that basically, you know, they claimed that it was intended to criminalize things like the Boston Marathon bombing. Or the 2015 Charleston massacre at a, you know, Black AME church. But instead, the first people to ever be prosecuted were young people sleeping in a hammock in a public forest that were there to protest the construction of this horrific cop training facility. So, you know, we see legislators saying they're passing a law for one reason and then using it to criminalize their enemies. But often what we also see is they'll pass laws and then prosecutors will never use them. You know, they'll put them on the books to try to scare us into submission, but they don't actually want to use them in a court because they know that we will file constitutional challenges against many of these laws. And oftentimes we win and these laws get struck from the book. So as the true bullies that they are, they'd like to keep the law on the books as a scare tactic, but they don't want to use it because they know that it's a weak law that might be subject to you know, constitutional challenge, and then they get rid of their little tool. More and more, we're seeing these really broad, you know, overly broad, ambiguous, vague laws being passed that are very ripe for constitutional challenges. That you will see quite a bit of as we move forward in the Atlanta cases. State repression also often will include unlawful arrests and excessive bail. You know, unlawful arrests, you know, for instance, down at Standing Rock, when that uprising was occurring, we saw tons of people basically being arrested for no reason. They were carted off to jail, their cars were impounded, and then the charges were dropped. The hope is that rounding up people that aren't doing anything wrong and aren't expecting to get arrested is a scare tactic that will keep people away. You know, their hope was like all these people from California that were heading to North Dakota to join in the protests might be scared away from joining in on those protests because you were just randomly getting cuffed and stuffed. Excessive bail, unlawful arrests can also be used for reasons like data gathering, you know, checking everybody's plates, checking everyone's IDs, and basically putting people into databases and giving them gang affiliations or extremist designations or other things like that. The idea is literally a brute force destruction of movement gains. You're gathering momentum for this protest, and then all of a sudden people are just randomly snatched and imprisoned. Oftentimes we will see sort of a guilt by association situation, which we are absolutely seeing in Atlanta right now, where, they're basically claiming that they're only, snatching up leaders of a movement for no real unknown reason, things like running a bail fund. And that is often going to be the case. Again, whenever you see things like this happening, really think about, is the intention of the state action to derail or demobilize a burgeoning social justice movement? And often reasons like, we call copaganda is like basically, while you're sitting in jail, police departments and the state are issuing press releases because they know that we can't respond while we're in jail. And then finally, toxic reactive anger from cops toward movements that are winning. We've seen that at Standing Rock and of course, Cop City. When you take on the largest cop training facility in the world, in an era where defund and so much scrutiny and open eyes, are occurring with regard to state violence and police misconduct. You expect, when you wave a red flag at that bull, you should expect to get the horns, as the saying goes. And so when you're going after the largest cop training facility in an era where cops are under a lot of negative scrutiny by the public, you expect them to come back with everything they've got in desperation. And that's what we're seeing. Excessive bail is also just a way to try to scare people away from engaging in activity that may risk arrest. Excessive bail is unconstitutional. It violates the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. With the advent of so many incredible bail funds that have happened over, the course of many years and across the country, that is our social movement's way of fighting back against the state tactic of excessive bail. They want excessive bail. We fundraise from our members, from our supporters, and we fight back against that tactic. The use of excessive bail keeps people in custody, perpetuates fear. It allows the cops again to, put forth their narrative while other people are incarcerated. And, even though we think that bail funds are amazing and serve so many incredible purposes, it's also real to know and acknowledge that most bail that is paid to the state, some percentage of it here in Oregon, 15% of bail that is paid is kept by the state, even if you are found not guilty. So cops wrongfully arrest you, throw you in jail, you pay $100 bail, they get to keep $15 of it just for the privilege of locking you up. So, make sure you understand, bail and bond and asking to be released on your own recognizance, which means in lieu of paying any money to the state. Just a few, kind of higher profile things that people are talking about these days in terms of state abuse of power with regard to the criminalization of activists and abuse of, overcharging, things like RICO, racketeering. This is just the definition of federal racketeering, but almost every state also has a RICO statute. And if you have been following along in Atlanta with Cop City, that is the Georgia state RICO statute that is being used there. In my 26 years of being a movement lawyer, this is only the second time that I've known of any activist being criminally charged with RICO in 26 years. So this is still a rare risk, a low risk. And obviously Atlanta is getting lots of attention, but when you're doing your risk assessments, people should not fear RICO to the extent that you decide to sit in front of a computer screen and hit like as your form of activism. Riot also something that was barely ever used in activist cases until Black Lives Matter occurred. And we could have a larger conversation about a movement that was led by Black people, had an overwhelming number of riot charges, and people basically calling, getting food and supplies for your family, was called looting rather than, liberating in many BIPOC communities. Conspiracy charges are the most common charge that activists and organizers face. It literally means two or more people that do anything in furtherance of a crime. You know, if you and I sit at a cafe and I sketch out a map to the bank and we talk about a bank robbery, that is often enough to warrant a criminal conspiracy charge. Now, this is the broadest net that the state can use against activist communities because it is such a low bar. And there's virtually not much you can do, to prevent technically conspiring, in a criminal sense. But do know that obviously the state can't go after a million people engaging in that type of activity. It's just that if you are targeted by the state for your incredible organizing work, for your leadership, they often will use conspiracy as the thing to rope you in. They will use conspiracy as a way to target you when and if they want to. Do remember that 98% of speech in the US is protected First Amendment speech. There's very little speech that is actually unprotected. We really self-censor ourselves in the US far more than we need to, often because we don't understand where the line is drawn between free speech and criminalized speech. So defamation is knowingly telling a lie about someone that causes economic harm. Obscenity is where your intention is to sexually arouse someone. And each state has a slightly different definition of obscenity. Fighting words and true threats, I'll talk about a little bit more. But hate speech is 100% protected by the First Amendment. It's only when you combine hate speech with an unlawful act like assault or harassment that it becomes a hate crime. When we're talking about incitement and advocacy of crime, I get up on stage and I say, let's get those pitchforks and go after Trump, type of thing. That is protected First Amendment fiery rhetoric. The Constitution protects the abstract teaching of the moral propriety or even moral necessity for a resort to violence or force. That is protected and is different than preparing a group for violent action. If I get up on stage and I say, let's go get Trump, that's protected speech. If I then hand out pitchforks to each of you and point across the street and say, that's where Trump is, go get him, then I can be held responsible for your actions. That's sort of the distinction between incitement and advocacy. In a post-Black Lives Matter timeframe, the courts have kind of come up with a very specific test. A true threat, like saying something like, we should destroy all courthouses. That is generally speaking First Amendment protected. But during Black Lives Matter, because so much was online, we actually did have clients that were prosecuted federally and faced many years in federal prison for things that they were posting in private chats on Facebook and Twitter and other social media that were being highly monitored by the government. So when you're trying to figure out, is what I'm posting a true threat or not, the courts are going to look at both the subjective intent, like what did you actually intend when you wrote that, and the objective intent. What would a reasonable person think you were intending? Would a reasonable person interpret what you wrote or what you said as threatening? Slap suits stand for strategic lawsuits against public participation. This is where corporations file frivolous lawsuits against their adversaries to try and shut them up. This again, in many ways is sort of a badge of honor. When a campaign is targeted by a corporation in a slap suit, That's because they are so desperate and pathetic and losing that they're attempting to use their unlimited power and money in the courthouse to try and derail your campaign, to try and shut you up. There is a coalition called Protect the Protest that I am a part of, and that over 35 NGOs are a part of, that will represent you for free if you're the target of a slap suit. We've got campaigns and comms people that will help, you know, double down on your campaign when it's targeted in this way. And we do a whole separate training on this. Just know that it is a form of state repression, but we are really fighting back hard on this. And in the last 10 years of slap lawsuits, CLDC has defended dozens of campaigns, activists, and organizers, and we have gotten every one of them dismissed to date. So yes, it's a risk, but the actual risk of being found liable is somewhat low. And it's still somewhat rare that activists and organizations are being slapped. In order to combat slap suits, one of the things that we really try to teach people is about document destruction and retention policies. Having a written policy that says every 30 days, you're going to destroy all the drafts that you no longer need, your text, your emails, you know, all your stuff. The reason that this is important is because if it no longer exists, even if you are slapped, you don't have to worry about turning it over to your enemies, turning it over to your adversaries. You know, often the reason corporations are slapping activists is because they want to psychologically profile and movement map your campaign. They want to know, how do you pick your targets? How do you fundraise? You know, who are the leaders? You know, how do you figure out how to run a campaign? They want to learn that so that they can try and fuck with it, you know, to try and destroy it, basically. And so by having fewer documents that exist, you can be like, huh, even if in the worst case scenario I am slapped, I'm doing harm reduction to my movement and my community by getting rid of the stuff that I know that my adversary is hunting for. You know, the gold that they are seeking does not exist on my computer and on my campaign. So take yourself seriously if you are a movement participant. You know, think about, number one, do I even need to write this down? Should it even be written down? You know, could the government or a corporation use my words to really negatively harm or impact a campaign or an activist, you know, or an individual? You know, and should you write it down? You know, should you put it on a crypt pad so that you can destroy one, you know, it for all for one? You know, be careful in the way you take notes. Do you need to use someone's full legal name? You know, do you need to put a level of detail together? You know, sarcasm, if it gets turned over to your enemy, becomes really problematic. And if you engage in some of these things that you actually can control. You know, there are many things when we're talking about state repression that you have power and control over. You can destroy all your old emails so that they don't exist. That is harm reduction to the movement and community. The more of these things that you can do for yourself and your community, the more power you will feel against this big bully. Excessive force or police brutality is also a form of state repression. When they, you know, show up in uniforms looking like a bunch of stormtroopers, that is to scare people from joining you, from showing up on the streets, from exercising their First Amendment rights. When they engage in excessive force and police brutality, not only are they breaking the law and violating your civil rights, but they're doing so in order to scare people from, you know, from joining you, from engaging in movement tactics. So, you know, what we're seeing right now, use of force, you know, is basically anything that they are doing, showing up in uniform, using batons, using sound weapons, using chemical weapons. You know, the militarization of our police forces in the US is horrific and historic. This is just basically what cops are trained on. You know, when you go to a cop academy, you are basically told that, like, you can escalate the level of force you use against the people If you can make certain justifications that they lie about, you know, it shouldn't be surprising to anyone here that cops absolutely lie all the time when they are engaging in investigations. They can commit crimes with you, they can do drugs with you, they can lie to you, they can date you, all while infiltrating movement spaces and investigating crimes. Grand juries are also a tool of state repression when they're used against political activists. This too is somewhat rare, but it's a boogeyman to political activists. You know, especially young organizers often come to me with a lot of fear and apprehension around grand juries. It is very rare that cops and the state will use grand juries and subpoena movement participants because they don't need to. They can just have one cop come in and read from a bunch of reports and spit out a bunch of hearsay. And, you know, the saying is that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich because basically it's a prosecutor in a room with a bunch of grand jurors and a court reporter. Nobody gets to argue the contrary position. And, you know, grand jurors generally want their bathroom breaks. So they're going to do what their friend, you know, the prosecutor tells them to do, which is indict you. Unless, of course, the person that is being grand juried is a cop, you know, for the death of a human, for the murder of a human. And then that prosecutor, who's best friends with the cops, will go to that grand jury and be like, you don't want to indict my friend, the cop. They're just doing their jobs. And oh, so what? They have to kill another person of color that's holding a cell phone. You know, you don't want cops to be afraid to do their jobs, do you? And that's why we very rarely see grand jury indictments against police for the murder of innocent humans. Racial profiling and bias is targeting individuals for police or security detention based on the color of their skin, based on their, you know, religion, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Cops like to call this bias-based policing instead of calling it racial profiling, which is what it is. This is just an interesting graph on the number of people incarcerated in the US based on both race and gender, and the prison policy initiative is the source of this graph. If you are into this and want to see more detail, they've got lots of great resources on their website. We have a saying here at the CLDC that awareness is two steps ahead and paranoia is two steps backward. The reason we say this is because it's extremely difficult to know whether or not your community is being infiltrated by the feds or by cops. It's actually a distraction and an energy suck of energy that basically gets people turning on each other. You know, when the state is trying to make you think you're being spied on, they're trying to increase your paranoia so that you will fear being an activist, you will fear working with others. You know, being paranoid is a win for the state. And so whenever we are thinking to ourselves, is this person a snitch? Are they an undercover? You know, if you are practicing good security culture that we will talk about in a minute, it really doesn't matter whether you are infiltrated by a government agent. If you're practicing good security culture, you should be able to organize and campaign and be effective in the face of that. And that's not to say that if you're sure you've got a cop in your midst, you shouldn't out them. You know, that's not to say that if you've got people exercising very poor judgment that are just sucking the life out of a campaign and are doing nothing positive and only negative things to your organizing efforts, tell them to leave. You know, as progressive movement spaces, we are not required to work with everyone that shows up. You know, and in moments of climate crisis and, you know, in moments of state repression, it is important to be effective, to be strategic. And if you can't do that with some of the people you're working with, you don't have to work with them. Rather than focusing on, is this person a cop or not, you should be focusing on, is this person effective? Do I trust this person? Can I work with this person? When we're talking about, you know, state repression and surveillance, we want to talk about threat modeling, which sometimes is a new term for activists. It's often used by military and cops and government agencies. But when we're talking about threat modeling, we're talking about articulating you know, what are our assets? What are the things that we want to keep safe from the state? Who are our adversaries? You know, are they corporations? Are they cops? Are they private security? What are our vulnerabilities? Like, where are the points where the state could cause harm? You know, is it doxing? Is it, you know, spying on your social media accounts? And then what will you do about it? You know, sometimes people are intimidated by engaging in threat modeling. It's kind of a scary term. But by the time you get to the end of this process and you're talking about what can we do about it, it's actually a liberating, exciting, exhilarating experience, because you will realize for most of the assets that you articulate that have vulnerabilities, there actually are workarounds. There are ways for you to be safer. And to protect those things. So what do you want to protect? Who do you want to protect it from? How likely is it that you will need to protect it? You know, like if you're organizing a bake sale, probably low risk of that. What are the likely consequences if you fail? You know, how serious is the harm in the event that you fail in protecting those assets? And how much trouble are you willing to go through in order to try to prevent that? You know, if we're talking about life in prison, you better go to as much effort as humanly possible, you know, to prevent that from happening. But, you know, maybe if it's lower risk, you know, or if you are engaged in, you know, really green organizing activities, you know, maybe using things like a VPN or high levels of digital security might not be necessary for everything. So this is just a different visual on assets, threats, vulnerabilities, you know, attacks. You know, cops show up and raid your house. That's an attack. You know, being doxxed is an attack. And then countermeasures. You know, that's that part that I really want you to focus on. Going through this process with your campaign and with your community and figuring out what are the countermeasures that you can all engage in to make yourself safer. You know, security culture is just a set of norms that activists engage in to keep ourselves safer. It includes things like you can always say no to any action at any time. If you don't feel safe, if it's not the right call for you, you don't have to do it. You know, don't be a tattletale. We picked a team. If you're on team movement, if you're on team activist, don't be a snitch and join team state. You can never come back to team movement. You know, once you cross the line and go over to team state, you're never coming back to our political organizing spaces. You've made that choice for life. So if you can't do the time, don't take the risk. You know, if knowledge and consent to the risks that you're taking is imperative in movement spaces. And then think very carefully about your public statements, whether that's on social media or otherwise. They will last forever. They will be downloaded. They can be used against you and others. So be, you know, think twice about what you post, what you write, et cetera, et cetera. Don't ask, don't tell, as it applies to movement spaces. You know, don't tell me about your past criminal activities. I didn't consent to knowing that. And now if the cops, or if, you know, a grand jury is convened and I'm subpoenaed, now I have stuff in my head that I didn't want there, you know, that you put there without my consent. That's don't ask, don't tell in a movement space. We are only as strong as our weakest link. That really, really is true in movement spaces. If there's 10 people in my group and all 9 of us delete our emails, we're really careful with our document destruction, but one person doesn't do it, we are only as strong as our weakest link. You know, all the efforts we just did to be safe have been completely undone by that weak link in our chain that did nothing. And so know that if you agree to engage in certain conduct, like deleting your emails, you are taking a serious responsibility duty to do that, because your other people in your group are relying on you. Their safety is tied to yours. So resisting mass surveillance, government mass surveillance, you know, mass surveillance is premised on the idea that the state wants to consolidate power in itself. The idea that Big Brother is watching, Sauron's eye is just sucking up all this data and information, and they want you to think that they know it all and they have it all. That's sort of like the idea of mass surveillance. But needle in a haystack really is a thing. Mass surveillance creates and reproduces the conditions for the accumulation of more power. That's why every one of us, should take a digital security training. We've got many on our websites for free, because mass surveillance really applies to all of us. Mass surveillance is a political process of domination. The population's ability to have demonstrations or to organize is greatly reduced when people don't have privacy from the prying eyes of state power, from cops, from government agencies. So when people say, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong, I'll just use Google Docs, or I'm not doing anything wrong, I'm going to post all this stuff to Facebook. Think in your head, we are keeping our organizing efforts private because if the state knows everything that we're planning and doing, we have less power. When we talk about the Fourth Amendment and your right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, which includes your writings and your thoughts and things like that, in the digital realm, the only way that we can say, I don't consent to this search is by using encryption. If you're posting things in a setting where the state can just suck it up, you are saying, I consent to the search and seizure of my information by the state. In order to assert the right to privacy, you have to create boundaries that protect against the unreasonable search and seizure. We can't know what information the state may be gathering at any given time, or how it might be used against you or others. But when everyone asserts a desire to protect our privacy, then it's not just radical activists that are singled out. Especially those that are normally targeted and marginalized, like communities of color, like trans activists, like anarchists, like, far leftists, those people are regularly targeted. If we join them in using certain levels of encryption, then they won't be targeted or singled out as easily.
This monster mouse, these 10 feet tall, with teeth and claws to match. You don't need to wonder.